From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we talk with St. Louis-based journalist Sarah Kendzior. Her book of essays, The View from Flyover Country, predicted the rise of Donald Trump as early as 2012.
We've had authoritarian policies. You know, we've had internment camps. We've had a lot of the same phenomena that fascist states have had. We just not have had them universally applied. And so I think that that does show it can happen here. It has happened here, and we're vulnerable.
Then musicians Robert Cohen and Josef Luptak join us to talk about the international music festival Luptak founded.
I was trying to find a way how to connect our world, which was still at the time quite isolated and was searching for much more openness to all parts of Europe and the world.
And Radio Chipstone meets a Madison man and his collection of Oscar Mayer memorabilia. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Sarah Kendzior is the kind of journalist that people love to hate. She's relentless in her pursuit of the truth. She does not mince words, and she's unafraid of powerful people. She is not in this business to make friends, and she's had the death threats to prove it.
Kendzior is also something of a soothsayer. Her essays, written for the Al Jazeera English Channel in 2012 and 2013, predicted the rise of Donald Trump and the outcome of the 2016 election before anyone else in the media was taking the campaign seriously. Those essays have been collected into a book called The View from Flyover Country. The book, which takes no prisoners, has been a New York Times bestseller, but it was originally self-published because no traditional publisher wanted it.
Kendzior was in Milwaukee earlier this summer for an appearance at Boswell Book Company, and I was invited to interview her in front of a packed audience there. We started with why the Midwest is such an important bellwether for the entire country.
You know, the kind of conditions that I describe in the book of a lack of opportunity, of economic misery, of corruption, those are conditions that you see nationwide. But I do think that since the recession in 2008, the Midwest has suffered disproportionately. You've seen, you know, an unequal recovery. You've seen cities like New York or San Francisco or Washington, D.C., you know, become these very powerful, very wealthy, and very expensive hubs of media, of politics, of entertainment, of all these industries, whereas industries in the Midwest, I think, have really bottomed out. You know, you see this in creative fields. Our newspapers are gutted. A lot of our cultural institutions were gutted. Businesses departed. And then some of this is an extension of things that already existed in the 70s and 80s with manufacturing shutting down. But I mean, I think if something does connect the Midwest as a region, because, you know, one thing I want to emphasize is that, you know, we are a diverse region. We are not this simplistic caricature that tends to be kind of bandied about by East Coast media. But the thing that does bind us is, you know, one, we're looked down upon. We're called things like flyover country. We're assumed to, you know, not have intellectual attributes or reasons to visit. And also, I think this sense of futurelessness, of sort of being left behind or being cut off from opportunities because it's become pay to play, and we just don't have the money. And so you get this weird paradox where it's affordable, you know, to live in a place like Milwaukee or a place like St. Louis. Not for everybody. I mean, that's something I need to emphasize, is that poverty here, I think, is worse than you see in a lot of these wealthier cities. So they struggle with poverty as well. But for sort of a, you know, average person, it's easier to kind of get by. But it's harder to find a job. It's harder to pursue, you know, whatever ambitions you have. Your opportunities are more narrow. And I think that that's happening, you know, not just in the Midwest. It's happening in the South. It's happening in parts of the Northeast. It's really an American phenomenon of the 21st century. But it's, you know, now it's producing worse effects politically, you know, which I'm sure we'll get into. But I think that the refusal to really deal with the repercussions of the recession and this false recovery, this underemployment, lack of benefits, constant instability, I think has come back to haunt us big
time. Wage stagnation,
yes,
is another,
exactly,
one, or wage reduction.
Right, right.
And that's something that we have certainly felt here. People who work for the university, people who work for the school systems, mm-hmm, you know, have seen their wages flatten out or go down, or they've lost their jobs.
Right, while cost of living soars, and it soars for things you can't opt out of, like your healthcare costs, childcare costs, you know, childbirth costs. You know, all these sorts of things that used to be, you know, kind of part of the package of life, like people didn't kind of freak out over them in the 50s or 60s or 70s, are now luxuries. And when you turn everyday necessities into luxuries and, you know, don't increase wages or any kind of economic ladder upward, you know, you're in for a real crisis.
These essays that are collected in this book were written between 4 and 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and I know you self-published them because people were interested in reading them all in one place. The thing that struck me in reading the book was that nothing's changed. If anything, yeah. It's gotten worse.
Oh, it's definitely gotten worse. You know, and it's sad for me to read this book, and now it's in greater circulation, and people are reading a lot of things for the first time that I wrote in 2012, 2013. They're like, oh God, someone's finally talking about this. And I'm like, man, you know, and it's not true. I mean, there are other people talking about it. There have been actually positive changes, I think, since I first wrote these, you know, in the labor movement, in, you know, Fight for 15 and organizations like that are pushing for a higher wage. But overall, the structural conditions, they've gotten worse. The strength of our institutions, much worse. And that's been tested continually since Trump got into office, because you're seeing every institution get tested, not these sort of norms, but actual laws and, you know, people behaving with a kind of impunity in terms of committing outright crime that we've never really seen before. So now we're kind of at a new level of, you know, downfall, unfortunately.
You talk about, you use Uzbekistan as an example for, you know, the idea that following the law is somehow illegal.
Yes. I mean, it's a weird thing. I get asked a lot now, you know, about resistance to Trump and how people counter. I mean, I guess I should give as a background, you know, I'm a journalist who lives in St. Louis. Lately, I've been covering Trump, U.S. politics. This book is primarily about U.S. politics, some foreign affairs. I also have a PhD from studying, it's in anthropology, but I studied authoritarian states of the former Soviet Union, in particular, Uzbekistan. And, you know, as I studied that, I didn't really think, well, this will be really helpful when I cover the campaign of future president of the United States, Donald Trump, and his burgeoning autocracy. That really wasn't what I thought I was going to use my PhD for. But, you know, for all those who say there's nothing you can do with your PhD, I've found the solution. But I studied dissidents. I studied how dissidents from Uzbekistan, but often living outside of Uzbekistan, because if you're a dissident in Uzbekistan, that's what happens, is you end up in exile, were trying to use the internet to bring the government down. And dissidents has been outlawed there for so long. You know, it's very different than America, where you can have protests. You know, we have a level of freedom of speech that's unimaginable there. So they kind of tended to frame their dissent in a way that it was subversive because it was emphasizing the rule of law. All they wanted was for their own officials to follow the rule of law. And so they'd set up these websites where ordinary Uzbeks could ask, like, what do I do if an officer is asking me for a bribe? What if I do if I find out that an official is, you know, stealing money from taxpayers and using it? And I keep thinking, my God, we're in this position now. And it's frustrating to me because, you know, we do have a free press. We do have free speech. It's not perfect. It never has been. But, you know, I'm able to sit here and talk to you right now, and I'm not afraid somebody's going to, like, pull up and come get me, and then I'll, you know, that'll be it for me. We can talk about this, but I feel like there's a reluctance in the press often to confront the severity of these issues head on. There's a reluctance to give people information about kleptocracy, about the level of corruption that we're experiencing, and some of that has to do with the relationship between big media companies and, you know, these corporations and these political systems of power. But, you know, I guess this is a long-winded answer, and the end of it is to say, speak up while you can, and treasure that right, you know, because not everybody has it. And if you have it, I think a lot really can be done.
Well, that's hopeful, because, you know, reading the book, I have to say, it made me very sad.
Oh, yeah, it's like a miserable book. Go buy it.
It took me much longer to read than it probably should have, because I kept having to put it down, going, oh, okay, all right, I need a cup of tea now. I need to go pet the cat.
Yeah, don't, you know? don't read this thing all at once, man. Yeah, you're going to, like, want to slit your throat. But, you know, I mean, I think ultimately, you know, kind of like my point at the end is, like, if we don't talk about these problems, if we're not, like, brutally honest about what we're facing, if we don't emphasize the conditions conditions of the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, the people who are suffering the most, there's no way we can fix them. And, you know, what is the point of all this? It's to try to make things better. It's to try to help people out. And so, unfortunately, part of that process is identifying really severe, often systemic problems and, you know, pulling them up at the roots.
Where do you think this began? Because this didn't begin in 2016. This didn't begin in 1990, I don't think.
No.
Where do you think that idea that somehow the foundations of civilization, as we think of them, as helping each other, as, you know, being better than the sum of our parts, when did that schism happen, do you think?
I mean, I think people, I mean, God, if you want to go all the way back in time, people have always been selfish. People have always struggled with that side of their nature, and there have always been efforts, you know, for societies to try to keep those conditions in check. And, you know, I'm an anthropologist, or I was, I guess, you know, that's what I studied in academia. So, you know, this plays out differently all over the world. In the U.S., you know, to just narrow the scope of this question a little bit, you know, I think the original sin is race. And I think most of our inequalities can be traced back to that, to slavery, to Native American genocide, to the treatment of Black Americans, and to that being legal. You know, after Trump was elected, we heard a lot of, oh, it can't happen here. There's no way we can have an autocracy. There's no way we can have an authoritarian system. And it's true that we do have a long-standing democratic system. You know, we have a constitution. We have things in place, you know, rights to freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, that usually ensure some sense of a democracy. But we've had authoritarian policies. You know, we've had Jim Crow laws. We've had internment camps. We've had a lot of the same phenomena that fascist states have had. We just not have had them universally applied. And so I think that that does show it can happen here. It has happened here, and we're vulnerable. And so what we need now, I think, is to confront, you know, those systemic flaws, you know, these atrocities, to be blunt, as well as look at, you know, other countries and how they've transitioned out of democracies into autocracies, because you're seeing this happen worldwide. We're not unique in that respect. You see Poland, Hungary, Turkey, all these countries kind of going down a dark road.
Although the Dutch voted in a good way. I mean, they went the other way.
Oh, yeah.
Which was really quite wonderful to see. And you look at the example of Germany, mm-hmm. which came from an incredibly awful situation and have reinvented themselves, but they confronted who they had been,
right,
and what they had done.
Right, and that's essential. And it's funny, because I was in both countries last year. I had this, like, sort of, you know, horrible world tour where I kept getting invited places because people were like, oh, God, is this going to happen to us? Like, let's bring her here to tell us. And I was always like, you know, yeah, unfortunately it can, and I don't think getting it, you know, asked back. But when I went to the Netherlands, it was right around that time when Geert Wilders, you know, was running, was possibly going to win. Like, that movement is still there. You know, and I think they're more aware of it. They saw what happened to us. They saw Brexit, which was also unexpected, and they're like, it could happen here. But I think your point about Germany is absolutely right. I spoke with German college students who had grown up being taught to recognize signs of fascism, how to read propaganda. They were taught, like, a level of critical media literacy that I think the U.S. kind of lacks, and which, of course, has been complicated by the internet. That's true for every country, and I think a lot of things we genuinely couldn't have predicted. But they knew it could happen. And they knew the risks and the dangers, and so they were much, much more aware. And I don't want to say they're cynical, they're practical minded when it came to these sorts of problems.
Do you think that something like that could be brought here, and what do you think it would take?
I think it needs to be. I mean, one challenge of anything for America is that day-to-day life is hard. You know, people are working sometimes multiple jobs. People are thinking about, you know, everyday things. How do I pay my bills? How do I take care of my kids? You know, do I have health insurance? And, you know, I work as a journalist full time, and I read like a zillion news stories every day. And I try to make sense of, for example, the Trump Russia case. And I struggle to make sense of all of this and to keep all this in my head. And every now and then, you know, something pops up, some weird memory of a story, like, you know, Peter Smith, the GOP operative who died mysteriously last year with a note next to him that said, I didn't kill myself, I swear. Like, you know, the kind of story that normally would last for like a year. We get like four or five of those every single day. And so it's basically impossible to keep all this stuff in your head. And I'm thinking, if this is literally my job and I get paid for this and I'm struggling, how the hell are normal people who work a 9-to-5 and come home and maybe like watch a little bit of TV news, kind of scan the internet, how are they making sense of this? I don't know. Because that's the thing, is these sort of literacy skills take time. And so what I'm often recommending is for people to, you know, just read more and read history. Because I think if you read history, both the US and abroad, you see these patterns. You know, autocracy often plays out in a familiar way. You know, they call it a dictator's playbook for a reason. And I think that if Americans kind of knew the signs of a kleptocracy, of an autocracy, and then just kind of looked at like basic stuff Trump is doing, like not divesting his businesses and being incredibly secret about it, then they're like, oh, we live in one of those kind of countries. We live in a country kind of like Azerbaijan or kind of like Uzbekistan. Not as bad, not quite as severe, but with the same motivations in the government. And then I think people start to think differently and more realistically about what's at stake.
Sarah Kendzior speaking with us at a book event earlier this summer at Boswell Book Company. We'll have the second part of the conversation when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Let's get back to our interview with journalist and author Sarah Kendzior, recorded at Boswell Book Company earlier this summer.
Kendzior begins this part of our interview by reflecting on her role as a Cassandra in modern clothing.
It's a weird thing. I'm always told that people aren't listening to me, and then I get these like big crowds. No, like, but you know, and it's interesting to me because it kind of makes me think they're just like, you know, no one's listening to Sarah Kendzior, and I'm thinking like, well, who's listening to me? Like, people who live in the Midwest, people don't have a lot of money, people who aren't white, a lot of women. Basically, all of the people who Trump targets are listening to me pretty hard, you know, because I think they realize, yes, this could happen here. Yes, our democracy is at stake. And so I do, you know, have this. It's just kind of like rich white dudes and corporations and in the media. They are listening to me because they're annoyed. They just don't want to acknowledge what I say until it's kind of too late. Like then the terrible thing that they said I was being an alarmist about or being hysterical about, these very gendered terms, then it happens. And then they're like, oh crap, she was right. And I'm also like, oh crap, I was right. Because who the hell wants this stuff to happen? Like I'd rather be wrong and be an alarmist and be hysterical and have a better, healthier nation. But yeah, you know, it is frustrating because so much of this is in the public domain. Like, I feel like when I die, like, that's going to be my tombstone. It was in the public domain. You know, Trump was an open book. You know, he committed open acts of corruption for 40 years. He went bankrupt multiple times. He had all these sex scandals. I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg. The Kremlin connections were in the public domain. I spent all of 2016 saying, I think this guy is an asset. And they're like, why? And I'm like, because of what your newspaper wrote in 1988. Which lays the whole thing out, because of what he wrote in The Art of the Deal. I mean, he confesses to his crimes. He gets off on confessing to his crimes. He doesn't want to be punished for them, but he likes to be caught, because being caught lying, being caught committing crimes is an act of power. It says, I am above the law, and I'm going to live above the law whether you like it or not. And so, you know, I kind of saw that coming. And, you know, in terms of the themes of this book, the structural problems we faced were in plain sight. You know, when you would hear about record low unemployment, and then you look around and you see crumbly buildings, empty lots, gutted malls, people working multiple jobs and living in homeless shelters, you kind of know that whatever these figures are, maybe technically unemployment is low because they're counting working at McDonald's 10 hours a week as being employed. You know, life has become harder. Like the struggle for people has become worse, and it's all in front of you. And I feel like there's been this collective gaslighting for, you know, I mean, probably more than 15 years. I mean, I'm sure, you know, we were talking before about Watergate, which was its own kind of gaslighting, or Iran-Contra, or these other sorts of things. But, you know, it beats down your consciousness. It makes you think, like, am I right? Am I going crazy? All this kind of stuff. And I think, you know, trust your gut and trust what you see in front of your eyes. And if somebody is announcing to the world, like, hey, I obstructed justice, they did. I mean, this is the world we're in, where the nightmare is reality. And, you know, the only way to kind of wake up for it is to confront that it's ongoing.
I think one of the other things that's frustrating that I hear from listeners and just in general conversation is that the structures that are supposed to be in place to check all of this are not doing their jobs. Whether Congress isn't doing what it's supposed to do, whether the courts aren't doing what they're supposed to do, whether people aren't voting. I mean, because that's another thing too. People feel completely disenfranchised. How do we break through that when the very structures that we've put up to protect us aren't doing that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on in that question.
I know.
First, you know, in terms of checks and balances, that's both in and out of our hands. You know, I think we have the power to pressure officials, to document what officials are doing, to encourage the officials who are trying to look out for our best interests despite, you know, the objections of the Trump administration. But in terms of voting, in terms of citizen action, I mean, I've seen more engagement, more commitment, more willingness to turn out, you know, incredible sacrifices of time and effort on behalf of ordinary citizens to try to turn this thing around. And it's not just about Trump. It's about issues like gun control. It's about women's rights. It's about science. It's about the environment. You know, we see massive protests about these things. We see huge engagement, and we've seen big turnout. You know, we have a Democratic senator from Alabama now. And so that's the whole element of this that's unpredictable. Like, the autocratic practices of the government are actually pretty easy to predict, especially with someone like Trump, who's been a public figure for 40 years, has left behind thousands of interviews, has told you his plans, you can kind of assume he's going to follow them. That's true for a lot of people in the administration. These are some old guys. I mean, they're, you know, sorry, that sounded rude. That's not what I meant. You know, these are men, they're almost all men, in their 70s, who have a long track record. And so you're able to predict where they're going to go. You can't predict public behavior. You can't predict how citizens will act. And I've been very pleasantly surprised by how citizens have acted. I feel like people are fighting back. And so that's good. And that, we'll see what happens in the midterms, because there are other challenges. There's voter suppression. There's the fact that I worry the GOP may just simply not accept the votes of a Democratic sweep or even just a Democratic win, because the unthinkable has become the possible these days. But I do have some hope when I look at what citizens are doing.
Well, and I can't let the media off the hook, and you certainly take the media to task in the book, and I think rightfully so. Maybe a good way to frame this is, what media are you talking about? Are you talking about all of it? I like to think the outfit that I work for tries really hard to tell the truth.
Right.
And to find the truth and tell the truth. We don't always succeed. We don't always do as good a job. But I like to think that we have ethics and that we have standards that we're trying to adhere to, and we're trying to tell people what's going on. I don't think every media outlet feels the same way.
No, they don't. And it's a mixed bag. And, you know, I'm in the media too. You know, we're a part of it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that there's, you know, outlets with the possible, well, with the exception of Fox News, Breitbart, and some of the more obvious, you know, Trump propaganda outlets, I don't know what else to call them, that are just one thing or the other. You know, most places are a mix of writers, and I think it's more useful to look at the individual journalist, look at their track record, look at the quality of their work, does it hold up over time, and kind of judge that way rather than dismissing anything wholesale. And also, you know, allow people to change and to learn from their mistakes. Like, I wish more people learned from their mistakes in 2016, but I'm glad that at least some of them did. But yeah, you know, one thing to talk about with the media is just the financial state of it, you know, which I get in this book. At around 2000-2001, there began a crisis, which at first had to do with the internet taking profits from print media and a kind of, you know, reorganization of how the whole thing operated. After the recession, the media was gutted. And what you saw was a conglomeration of journalists in the most expensive, most elite cities in the country, you know, in New York, DC, San Francisco, LA, a little bit Chicago. Now, one out of four journalists lives in cities like that, and there are whole areas of the country that aren't covered at all. When you have that, and when you have these sort of unpaid internships and you know, expensive master's degrees suddenly being required, you get a very elite, privileged group of people telling you the news, who I don't think are completely in touch with the everyday reality of people, and who are also, you know, they look at somebody like Trump maybe as more familiar, or they look at their life, which has been so easy, and think it can't possibly be that bad here. Things can't possibly get worse. I mean, I just heard that over and over. You know, this sort of optimism, which maybe is just an American quality. It's American exceptionalism. But in the media, I don't know. But at the same time, the other thing is that they recognize they had a cash cow in Trump. They recognize he was great for business. He was great for ratings. They said it outright. You know, Les Moonves of CBS said he's, you know, he's terrible for America, but he's great for CBS. Jeff Zucker from CNN had a framed Trump tweet on his wall. He hired Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, while he was still getting paid by the Trump campaign. That's not an independent media. That that's the kind of thing you would see in a country like Russia or like Hungary, or places where independent media is getting cracked down on but hasn't been completely eliminated, although Russia at this point it almost has. And that's very worrisome, because that hasn't changed. I see people making the same mistakes. I see, you know, basically what I've been calling court stenographers, people who just, you know, Trump lies and they just repeat the lie. And he tweets, you know, he tweets because he doesn't want to have press conferences. He doesn't want to answer questions. He wants a one-sided conversation. And he puts slogans in those tweets over and over, you know, witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt. And those slogans are lies. And then the press repeats the lie. It's like this giant echo chamber that often can go unchallenged. And they need to step up, and they need to kind of study how propaganda works, and kind of think how are these old tactics, because this is like the same stuff Hitler did, you know, from like the Lügen Press to Leni Riefenstahl's documentaries to the big lie concept of Goebbels. I mean, this is literally the same stuff that he did translated into the digital age. And I just wish people would be more thoughtful about what they're doing when they cover this man.
Do you think journalists in some of those more well-paid, because certainly public radio isn't terribly well-paid, and I'm sure you're not making a fortune with what you're doing. Do you think they're afraid for their jobs? Do you think that they're basically looking over their shoulders going, I can't do that because my family will be destitute?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know they are, because some of them have told me. You know, and I do feel bad for them. I mean, these aren't people who are actively out lying and being propagandists and whatnot. These are people who just feel like they would like to leave. They would like to do something else, you know, and do more honest work, work with more integrity, more independence, and they feel like they can't. And that's the thing, is journalists are in a financial squeeze, and they're often in a position where they have a, you know, kind of a demand on the amount of material that they need to produce that's just enormous. It's just like, you know, write 8 articles a day for clicks. You know, there's a lack of investigative reporting. There's a lack of overseas reporting. You know, those are things that we've lost big time, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years as we've transitioned into the internet. And there still are reporters doing this kind of work, and they're doing a good job, and it's necessary, but we need more of it. And, you know, I do think for a lot of journalists, it's not necessarily a choice they're making. They're not waking up each day thinking, you know, I'm going to be a Trump propagandist, I'm going to boost him. A lot of it is exhaustion, laziness, desperation, dealing with the lawyers of different corporations. I know this is something I've had to deal with as a freelancer. You know, the editor loves it, and then I know it's going to the lawyers. And there were points where the lawyers would be, you know, perplexed that I said things like Paul Manafort worked for Russian oligarchs, like a fact. I mean, it's like in Paul Manafort's biography. Like, you can get it, you know, like he has admitted it. So I'm kind of like, I think it's all right, everybody. And there's so much anxiety. There's so much fear. And that often is as much of a factor as any kind of, you know, ideological bent.
Well, and that's how dictatorships happen. It's fear is a big part of that.
Yes.
And that's something you talk about a lot here, is that's the thing, that's the cycle that keeps happening.
Right. And it's, you know, a lot of it is financial. And with Trump, you know, his sort of group of people, his group of lawyers slash mobsters slash fixers have been very adept at bullying and manipulating the media for decades. And so, you know, they've used those exact same tactics. Things like excessive litigation. That's why we don't have Gawker. And granted, you know, I had a lot of problems with Gawker. But, you know, Peter Thiel, on behalf of Trump, shook that place down to the ground. And I think that that's the kind of censorship we're probably going to be seeing more of in the U.S. It's not going to be a decree from on high. It's not going to be like we're repealing the First Amendment and we're going to tell you about that. It's going to be people suing each other, people threatening each other, people bullying each other. And then, you know, you definitely see things like this kind of culture of conformity where everyone's afraid to be, you know, the hysterical person in the room. And I'm like, you know, hey, I'll take that role because, you know, it's necessary. Like, you got to tell the truth. It's often an unpopular thing to do. It's often very unpleasant to do when you're talking about terrible things happening to people, but it's necessary. And, you know, I encourage journalists, when they see something quite blatant and terrible, don't feel afraid to say that it is and that it's upsetting, because it's upsetting for everyone experiencing it, and we're in this together. I think the more we see that, the better off we are.
Sarah Kendzior is a St. Louis-based journalist, scholar, and the author of The View from Flyover Country. The book is a collection of essays she originally wrote for Al Jazeera in 2012 and 2013. We spoke with her about them at an appearance at Boswell Book Company earlier this summer.
We'll take another break, and then our On That Note contributor Robert Cohen joins us on the line from London with a special guest calling in from Slovakia. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. ¶¶ Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Every month we talk with cellist Robert Cohen about the life of a touring professional musician in a segment called On That Note. Robert is getting ready to go to Slovakia to perform as part of a festival called Convergences. The event has a special place in his heart because the festival's founder, Josef Luptak, was once a student of Robert's.
So we reached out, and not only does Robert Cohen join us from London, but Josef Luptak joins us from Bratislava, a first for Lake Effect. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Great to hear you, Bonnie.
Josef is our special guest today, and Robert, can you explain to me why you invited him on the program?
Well, because he's such a natural choice for me, you know, he's been, you know, he started off as a student of mine way back, and we became then really close friends, and even his wife to be got, they got engaged when they were visiting us in London in our house. So
yes, that's right.
We have a fantastic connection, and his children and our children have grown in a way together, despite being in different countries. We just had this, you know, long, long relationship, not only personal, but musical relationship as well. And since I'm very soon about to go to play again at Josef's amazing festival in Bratislava, in Slovakia, I just thought, well, I'm going to be seeing him soon, but it would be great to be talking to him with you about the festival and just, you know, whatever the topic comes up as usual.
And Josef, it's such a pleasure to meet you over Skype, and I hope that we get to do it at some point in person. But I want to start with the festival itself. Why did you want to start this?
Well, it's going back some time. And as Robert mentioned, when I've been studying with him at the Royal Academy in 1996-97, I was kind of dreaming about creating something special in Slovakia, which would connect with the special atmosphere we had in town before the communism. Because, as you know, in 1989, we had the fall of communism at the Velvet Revolution. So it was a few years after that, and then we could start to travel, me as a musician as well, and study abroad. And I was so lucky that I could study with Robert, and not just study, but having a really close relationship and even staying in his house, which was really, really nice. And in 1997, I could experience Robert's festival in South England, in Charleston. So I mentioned that because that was one of my inspirations. And another inspiration was just before I was at Royal Academy, I was part at the special arts program in Banff Art Center in Canada. So that was maybe another inspiration. And talking to kind of older friends from Bratislava, which was before called as Pressburg or Pozsony in Hungarian or German names, and was very, very lively musical town, because, as you know, we have all these traditions very close to us, like Vienna and or Eisenstadt, which is Haydn, Beethoven, Mozart. Hummel was directly from Bratislava, then later on Bartok or Dohnányi. All this history is connected to our town. And during the communism, all this kind of atmosphere of musicality was actually still held there, but it was not so natural as before the communism, because in the communism, many things went just centrally organized and were state organized. So this was kind of attempt to create something which was independent and more free.
It's also a way, I think, of connecting, so as you say, so many composers that we listen to now, whose music that we perform now, came from that part of the world. And when the Iron Curtain came down, the players from there couldn't mingle with the players on the other side. And Robert, you've talked about performing behind the Iron Curtain before it was lifted, and how interesting and difficult that was.
Yes, you know, and the connection to Bratislava for me came in about 1980 when I went to take part in a competition, an international music competition, which took me to Czechoslovakia, as it was then, and the very grey and dark atmosphere generally, but then how extraordinarily exciting it was to make music there. As Joseph says, it was very much part of the system and part of the general culture there. But it, well, then it has changed so much. Now, when I go to Bratislava now, to Joseph's festival, it's altogether much brighter and more open, and musicians from around the world are going there. And I think that, you know, just witnessing that huge change, but not living it in the way that Joseph did. And I think that what Joseph and his musical and artistic colleagues bring to the culture now in Bratislava is very extraordinary, because it has that flavor of understanding how things were and how important it was, and bringing that to a more international audience now, an audience where music is just something you can do if you want to. It's not so much something that everybody just did in those days.
Joseph, do you feel that you play music differently now?
Well, in many ways, yes, definitely. Because, you know, after, especially now after 1989, we were much more open to other thoughts, ideas, and even philosophies. So we were not so much connected anymore to the eastern part of our, you know, region, or just the countries which were connected in the Soviet kind of region. But we were much more open to understand how people from the Anglo, you know, American and Western countries understand music, and how they communicate the music, and how they perform it, and how they play. What we thought one way, they do it different. So it was very enriching for me, especially. And that was one of the things, as Robert said, that yes, it was one of the layers of the name of my festival, Convergence, was that I was trying to find a way how to connect our world, which was still at the time quite isolated, and was searching for openness, much more openness to the all parts of Europe and the world. So that was one of the layers. And another layer would be that connecting different styles, maybe, which was quite unusual at the time anyway. And to create something like independent chamber music festival, or even on an international level, was something understood as totally crazy idea, because I had no funds for that. I had no experience with it. So we really started with a small 3 concerts in 2000. And even Robert was part of the even pre-festival events, which was, it started 2 years ago, like 98 and 99, as a series of events, chamber concerts, masterclasses. And one of the guests of those events was Robert at that time. So he was very regular and very encouraging friends, because he was known in Bratislava for his mastery and for his artistry. And it was very big help for us that he is part of the program. So, and of course, personally for me, it was incredibly encouraging as well.
For me personally, what has also changed, I mean, Joseph's reminding me of those days, that, you know, when I used to play in Slovakia and then with other musicians, especially at that time with Slovak musicians, they hadn't had the experience of playing in a way with my sense of freedom in musicality. They were very much influenced by the old Slavic system, you know, the Russian styles. They'd been taught in a Russian style for decades. And so when I started to play with them, I realized that there were huge advantages in having had that background. But the disadvantages were a lack of experimentation, a lack of individual exploration of music and so on. And over the years, now those musicians, having had the chance, as Joseph said, to go out of the country as well, and since Western musicians have gone into Slovakia, their whole music making, I feel, has grown and adapted to take on all of the advantages of both systems, if you like. So in Joseph's festival, you also have so many different types of music and different types of musicians, folk musicians and jazz musicians. A lot of them are Slovak musicians, but there's always been some non-Slovak musicians in there. And now the mix is, well, it's very inspiring, because I have to say, when I listen or play with those musicians, they have a kind of depth that comes from this background, but this excitement that comes from the new world idea.
Robert, do you remember what you played the first time you were at Convergence?
Oh, I'm so bad at this.
I do remember.
If I may say,
I know that Robert in 1999, he had the masterclass, and truly, I don't remember if he had recital or not. That I don't remember. But in 2001, which was our first kind of bigger scale program festival, we were playing a Schubert string quintet in C major for two celli.
Oh, yes. Well, like, that brings the cellists
arpeggione
together.
Sonata. Yes, arpeggione sonata in the first half, and Britten solo cello sonata, because we wanted to bring something from his world, from England, from Britten. So I think this was the very first program.
It sounds like a wonderful program.
Yes, it was great.
I'm so impressed you remember.
And so I have to ask, what are you playing on this one?
Well, I'm involved in a lot of different pieces this time. So in chamber works, from Tchaikovsky's Souvenir of Florence, the sextet, which is so fantastic, and Schoenberg, Verklärte Nacht, which is a really moving, fabulous, dark sextet as well, to duos by Beethoven and piano trios by Beethoven, a whole variety of different things, and including some Reinhold Glier duos for two cellos, because I think we always feel we need to have that. We need that little opportunity to do something very personal,
yes,
together, don't we?
Yeah, exactly.
And Joseph, are you playing something else besides the Glier with Robert?
Well, I do. We have one extra concert where I perform, where Robert does not perform, or actually two concerts extra, which one is dedicated to 100 years anniversary of Czechoslovakia, which was founded in 1918. And of course, unfortunately, doesn't exist anymore. But we do remember this as a very significant era. And I grew up in Czechoslovakia. So we mixed Slovak and Czech composers like Dvořák and Jan Levoslav Bela, or Bohuslav Martinů and Eugen Suchoň. And what is special about this year, 2018, in my country, is that there's been many shakings in the political world. And maybe you have heard or not, there's been one journalist killed in end of February this year, and his fiance. And there are two new pieces premiered at my festival dedicated to Jan Kuciak and Martina Kušnírová, which I feel as a very important part of this time. And also there will be a special guest at the very opening concert, singer and violinist Iva Bitová, who is a Czech, but originally from Slovakia, but she's Czech artist living now in America, and a very significant artist. And she is having her anniversary year this year. So we invited her, and we will be doing from some folk songs by Bartók, by Janáček, and even Luciano Berio, and some improvisations together, two of us. So there will be lots and lots of program, but the final two concerts are with Robert and also with our common friend with Miguel and other players from Slovakia and elsewhere.
Internationally renowned cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month for a series called On That Note. This month, he was joined by friend and fellow cellist Josef Luptak, who founded the upcoming international music festival called Convergences, which takes place next week in Bratislava.
Coming up next, Radio Chipstone explores the world of Oscar Mayer memorabilia when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. After operating for nearly 100 years on the east side of Madison, the Oscar Mayer plant closed its doors just over a year ago. Matt Treadaway grew up in the shadow of that plant, and he didn't follow his father's footsteps and become an employee, but he did inherit his dad's love for all things related to the bologna with a famous first name.
It was a Sunday afternoon when contributor Jonifer Fields caught up with Treadaway, who was showing his collection in the basement of a church. He has rare objects like the uniform worn by famous Wisconsinite Meinhard Rabe, who was the first Little Oscar spokesperson for Oscar Mayer. But mostly Treadaway is surrounded by all kinds of wienermobiles, small whistles made of plastic, child-sized pedalmobiles, and even plush ones perfect for cuddling.
It started 19 years ago. My fiance at that time, she kind of talked me into, I hate to say it, but disability. Because my feet, and I'm diabetic. I've had 42 surgeries. I used to be a workaholic. And I thought, what am I going to do if I go on disability? I had panic attacks. And so she showed me how to get on eBay. And I started selling Christmas CDs on eBay. And somehow I came across an Oscar Mayer site, and I bought some whistles, and that kind of started the bite into collecting.
I don't know why. I guess because you're surrounded by this Oscar Mayer stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought you at one point maybe worked for Oscar Mayer, but this is outside of that.
My dad worked there for 28 years. I have his retirement folder over there, but I've never worked there, but every time we drive by, I just had just a love for that building.
Could part of it be a nostalgia and a connection to your father? When you look at these items, do you hear stories that he may have told you, or just even recounting his day at work?
Mm-hmm. He keeps saying over and over and over how the Oscar Mayer family would go through the plant and talk to the employees, and they were very family-oriented. And he just appreciated that. And, they treated him very well. They treated a lot of people very well. Behind the plant, they put in a baseball field for the families to play baseball with the kids. And, I just can't say enough for them.
So then, is that part of your collecting? Because I look over here, and I don't see that you have one electronic Wienermobile. You have several. You have several large cars. It's one thing to collect an item because it has a nostalgic pull to it, but why so many?
I can never get enough. One item that I'm very proud of is over in that corner. That is the very first building that they built back in 1890. Well, that they kept adding on to that, and that became the Chicago plant. Over on that table there is a brick from the Chicago plant. And then that big white brick, that's from the Madison plant. I met the son of one of the two families who had purchased the property of Oscar Mayer, and I worked out a deal, and that, to me, is a dream come true. So I wanted a brick from Chicago and one from Madison.
So it's not that it's the single thing that brings you joy. It's all the things that bring you joy. So is this, this is a pretty good, how many items do we have here? Like, ballpark it for me.
That's a pretty good question.
200 maybe?
Yeah, that'd be a good guess.
So then is this your entire collection?
No, this doesn't even scratch the surface. I have a 10 by 20 storage unit that I have most of it in, aside from the basement of where I live.
Is this a collection or an obsession? Are you crossing a line here with this?
It started out as a collection, but you know, I've done talks of the history of Oscar Mayer, and now it's obsession. What I'm looking for now are the real rare items, something that I don't have in the collection. I have hundreds of Wienermobiles that you just see everywhere. But I would, you know, like those, the two bricks, those are rare. It's not exactly what somebody else would have. Mainhart Robbie, his uniform, I have the certificate of authenticity of that with his personal signature. How many people have a certificate of authenticity with his signature on it? That's a prized possession for me.
So now, how did you come across that prized possession?
You know how rock bands have groupies? I have my own Oscar Mayer groupies, and to this day, I have no idea who called me. But they gave a heads up of a gentleman that I knew. His whole family knew me. He had passed away, and that's how I came across that.
This is a serious subculture.
Yeah.
Has it gained more traction since the plant closed?
I think it has. It's almost like a lot of people yesterday was telling me it's like a reunion. The old employees come in and they see each other and they sit down and they get talking and reminiscing. And I just love listening to that or talking to them.
So you're a collector of objects and the narratives. You want both.
Yeah. Because that's talking to somebody who actually worked at the plant or for the company. That's how I learned a lot about the history, aside from research or what have you. Down in the basement of where I live, I have quite a few items that I just, this sounds weird, but I just, you know, my computer's down there, and every now and then I'll just turn around and look at what I've got, and I just, I love it. I'm in awe of what I have. I guess words can't reveal my love for the family. Yesterday, one of the family members came here, and I was in such awe that I met that person. That made my day. That made my year, to actually meet a Mayer from the family.
So, how close in proximity do you live to the plant?
Half a mile. When I turned 18, I got married, and I couldn't wait to move as far away from my parents as possible. I made it to Middleton.
Were you driving a Wienermobile? Is that what held you back?
I would love to have a Wienermobile.
Have you ever contacted them and asked if you could drive?
No.
Is that just too much for you, Matt?
Yes. I would love to ride in one, but I wouldn't drive it. I'd be too uptight.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
On this episode, Jonifer spoke with Matt Treadaway of Madison. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.